The future of guns and hemp in Florida, Maduro is using illegal gold to stay in power, and there aren't enough female directors in horror films. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Today we spoke with Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried about how the recent mass shootings this weekend could guide the conversation about guns in Tallahassee.
I made a promise to the citizens of our state when I ran that the NRA would no longer be part of my administration.
And we talked with her about hemp and legal pot in the state. Also, Venezuela's oil industry is no longer providing the money that it used to enjoy. A new Miami Herald report shows that gold could be the only thing keeping Maduro in power. And the horror film genre is mostly directed by men, but that's slowly changing. We'll look at this year's Popcorn Frights Film Festival with a focus on the women leading the new generation of writers and directors. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, over the weekend, two mass shootings left, at the most recent count this afternoon, 32 people dead and many more wounded. Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried was among a number of Florida lawmakers calling for national leaders to step in. She tweeted this on Sunday, quote, "We are the only nation where murderers and the mentally ill can access weapons of war that can cause mass deaths in seconds. We must take action to stop the hate-fueled violence. Otherwise, our country is in denial and our citizens are paying the price in blood," end quote. We spoke with Commissioner Fried about actions that she can take as agriculture commissioner in a Republican-controlled legislature and cabinet. And she also explained Florida's complicated relationship with hemp and marijuana. Commissioner, I want to start with what's in the headlines. We just had a weekend with two mass shootings. One in Dayton, Ohio, one in El Paso, Texas, 29 people killed. Florida has had these tragedies. We had Parkland. We had Pulse. What was your reaction when you saw the news this weekend?
Anger. I was heartbroken and angry that this is continuing to happen. I mean, I was used to live in Broward County, and you know, those kids that experience what happened in Parkland is just heartbreaking. And then I'm actually been here in Orlando over the weekend and was at the Pulse Memorial a few weeks ago, and the fact that we are still having tragedies like this all across the country makes you kind of stop and think what's going on. There must be a disconnect between society and what's happening. I don't know if it's heated up because of things that are going on at a national level, all of the fear that's being put out there and hatred, or it's, just like simple, the fact that we have lost touch with interaction with people. You know, everybody's so glued and tied to their cell phones and to video games and to the internet. I think we've lost our moral compass in the country, and we need to start doing some deep dives in our souls and see what's going on and start having some action. We have the prayers and tears is long since gone. And while of course we feel it, heartbreak for everybody that's lost this weekend, but it just reminds us that we have to start moving forward and take action and figure out what's going on, because we can't live like this.
And when you talk about taking action, I mean, look, there's so many different angles of this, the mental health issue, and we talk about hate speech and so forth, but of course one thing will be guns. What do you envision the conversation about assault weapons and guns in general will be in the next session?
I think that we all have to take a step back. And unfortunately, what I've seen a lot on these gun debates is everybody has drawn their lines in the sand and have gone to their two corners. And that doesn't get good pieces of legislation in place. Everybody needs to come down and sit together and not with knee-jerk reactions in the legislature to piecemeal something, but sit down and have these conversations. And maybe it's not the politicians. It's the people that are being affected by this. It's law enforcement. It's the parents. It's the kids that are going to school every day in fear. And having these actual conversations of what is happening, what do we need to be doing? Because what the politicians, we haven't gotten it right. We haven't gotten it right since Columbine. And we continue to say, we all talk about, some type of, actions right after mass killings, and then everybody gets quiet again. But unfortunately, these mass killings are happening once a week. I mean, this is something that we need to take a step back, sit down like adults, and come up with some resolutions to all of this, whether it's mental health, whether, it's, certain, sensible legislation. I don't have the answers, but I know that us doing nothing is not the answer. And we've got to sit down at a table and figure this out.
You yourself, you're a gun owner.
I am.
And so, I mean, what would policy look like? You know, sensible gun control, because as you said, people have gone off into their corners. How do you bring them back into a table to sit down and talk and find something that works for everybody?
We have no choice. This is no longer a choice conversation and when it's convenient for all of us to have these talks. How many mothers have to die protecting their two-month-old babies? How many kids have to go to school and at the end of the day not come home? I mean, this is not something that we can sit back and wait. We've got to come together. This is literally life and death in our country. And if we don't take action and we don't step up and don't start leading, the next mass murderers are down the street, are, you know, in the next coming weeks. I mean, we've got to be serious and start taking action on this. And when I say action, I said, we really need to sit down and have a conversation, both sides of the aisle and both sides of this conversation, you know, have Moms Demand Action in a room with the NRA, come up with something. And that's the only way that we're going to move forward and start to heal is because we've got to do this together. This has been dividing our country since the beginning, and we no longer have, time is not on our side. I can't watch another headline where I'm seeing these horrific pictures and stories that are coming out that just break your heart. And, you know, the law enforcement officers who run into danger every single day, we have to take action and be proactive on this because we don't have a choice. This is no longer something that we can wait for another mass murder to come along.
And there is a proposal on for the 2020 November ballot in Florida that would put an outright ban on assault weapons. What's your thought on that?
I have not engaged on that issue. This is something that the citizens of our state, if it's on the ballot, you know, that's where they have part to say. But that's also because, you know, the politicians haven't done anything on this issue. And that's, you know, what I've also been very vocal on is the fact of Citizens Initiative. You know, that's when I saw, you know, when I started campaigning, talking about the 71% of our Floridians who voted for access to medical marijuana and how the legislature and the previous governor stood in the way of real implementation of this medicine. So I've always been a proponent of, you know, citizens having their day at the ballot box, whether it's for their elected officials or for Citizens Initiatives, because that's the only way that we've been able to move our state forward. You know, the fact that the past legislature, you know, tried to make it harder for these initiatives to be on the ballots really goes to the core of some of the issues that we fight every single day.
But the thing that you do have, you know, a say in is obviously as the agriculture commissioner is the gun permits. And right now, the system that we have in Florida, can people be confident that certain individuals can't get those permits, especially for assault weapons or through loopholes?
I made a promise to the citizens of our state when I ran that the NRA would no longer be part of my administration and that every single person who applies for a concealed weapons permit is going to have a thorough and complete background check. And I can tell you with complete confidence that is exactly what we are doing. The citizens of our state expect that from their leaders to make sure that, you know, what is in my power and control is making sure our citizens are safe and protected and that the background checks are done. And that's what we've done. We came in and completely revamped the entire program, put new leadership at the top of the division. And now all of our background checks are done and thorough. And we've been more efficient in it, too. We've been able to drop the wait times and be more efficient. We have 20 new full-time positions. And even when we first came in, we had people working overtime just to catch up on the backlog. But I can guarantee you, and the promise that I made to the citizens when I declared for office is a promise that I live with every single day, and I will not fail.
I'm talking with Florida Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. We're talking about the two mass shootings that occurred over the weekend and the impact that they could have on gun control policy in Florida. But I want to switch gears now. Let's go and talk about a very different subject, one that also is controversial, hemp. So help me understand, Commissioner, the new farm bill that went into effect July 1st, did it effectively legalize the sale and growth of hemp nationally?
What it did was it took hemp off of the Schedule 1, which is where it was with the rest of the cannabis plant, and allowed each state to create their own hemp program. And that's for the cultivation aspects of it and anything that comes after the hemp plant. So many of our states across the country in this past legislative session, in fact, passed hemp rules and hemp laws. And the USDA is also working to, because what happens is if a state does not do their own, they then opt into the federal one. So the USDA is also working on theirs. And hopefully by the end of the year, once we get our rules in place, we'll get seeds in the ground in 2019.
To set the context here, remind us of the difference between hemp and marijuana that someone might smoke or eat?
Marijuana has THC in it, which is going to have the euphoric aspect, which is what we have here in our state, the medical marijuana program, where I think everybody is well aware that we have 22 licenses across the entire state. Everything is vertically integrated, whereas hemp is non-euphoric. It can be used either for industrial side, which is really what makes me the most excited about the program, because there's 25 to 35,000 known usages for the hemp plant. And that's everything from being able to replace our styrofoams and our plastics and our paper and cotton, and even create hempcrete, which is better building material and fibers. So this is really something that's going to be the industrial revolution, and it's all biodegradable, better for the environment. So I'm super excited about the industrial side. And then the other part of the plant can be used for human and animal consumption. That's where you hear about the CBD, hemp CBD oils and products out there that have been unregulated and unchecked across the entire country. We have the ability here in Florida, once our rules are in place, to be able to create rules and regulations and testing standards and labeling requirements, so that when somebody buys a product in the state of Florida, they know that it's safe for human consumption. They know exactly what's in there. We are seeing all across the state when somebody has bought some type of hemp, CBD product, sometimes it has THC in it, sometimes it has no CBD in it or other chemicals. So it's really important for people to understand that CBD is not going to get you high, but it's actually a great health and wellness product. I'm hearing plans.
So, but how do you tell the difference between the two?
Well, in its raw formula, as far as just the flower itself, you can't. It's unless you have it tested. You can't. The smell is the same. It looks the same. And just by, the common eye, you're not going to be able to tell the difference.
So this leads to the controversy about how police officers go about arresting somebody. Let's look at a scenario. Imagine an officer pulls somebody over. They think they see pot. All right. So, do we have to train officers now in knowing the difference between the federally illegal marijuana and the fully legal hemp?
By eye, an officer and even the canine dogs are not going to be able to tell the difference. So what I've seen a lot of the state attorneys do across the entire state is put out, you need to have odor plus, which means you just can't, know the difference if you see the cannabis in the car, whether that's going to be marijuana or hemp. Well, so an officer needs to do, and if they're actually going to arrest, they have to find something else. Has there been irregularities in the behavior, driving patterns, other types of things, impairment that is going to be allowed to do an arrest? And then we're working on, we've had a few companies come to us already and show demonstrations of the on-the-field tests that are going to be out there. And so then kind of like if the officer was on the spot test, if there was cocaine and it goes into a bottle and you can be able to tell immediately.
So
they're working on those tests, and we're going to be able to get those over to law enforcement.
In Martin County, the sheriff told his officers don't make marijuana arrests because it's hard to tell the difference. What are you hearing from law enforcement?
I'm hearing a lot of the same thing. I was actually at the Sheriff's Association last week, and we're hearing a lot of that and hearing how do we tell the difference and asking just questions. And a lot of it is not understanding what is happening. And so we are spending a lot of time. We have an entire ag law division inside of the Department of Agriculture. Our ag law is working hand in hand with FDLE and sheriffs and police chiefs all across the state. We want to make sure that they have a seat at the table. And if there's things that we can do when we're doing our rules that are going to be easier to make sure they're doing their job, we're going to make sure that we're working with them. So we are hearing just kind of questions as far as what to do in those circumstances, and we're going to be working with them to make sure that they understand what the law is today, because the last thing we want to do is put one, law enforcement in any harm's way when they're just trying to do their job, and two, that they can still do their job, and that means obviously arrest of those who are illegally in possession of marijuana.
So the state of Florida is still trying to work out how to handle medical marijuana, which the voters passed. But there's a petition to get recreational marijuana on the November ballot. The language is now being reviewed by the Florida Supreme Court. If it gets to that point, is Florida ready for that?
It's kind of funny, how if we had this conversation 5 years ago, I say absolutely not. People still have a stigma associated with it. There was still just uncertainty. But I think that now everybody's hearing the stories of how medical marijuana is helping people. It is helping people get off of their opiates, getting, a better quality of life, is more safe than all the other pharmaceutical drugs that are out there. And so you're changing the climate and acceptance of the marijuana plant itself. And then you start having the more more intellectual conversations. Well, this has an opportunity to create revenue, taxable, you know, resources to go into education, to infrastructure, job growth, and then starts to decrease the, as far as the criminal justice, and start having, you know, less people in our jail system and bogging down our courts. And so you're now having less and decrease in the amount of infrastructure needed in the criminal justice system. So people start kind of saying, okay, well, maybe this isn't so bad. So I think that, you know, we're getting there, whether it's on the 2020 ballot or 2022, it's just a matter of time. And we're even seeing a difference in opinions and just acceptance when it comes to the federal level. I mean, look at some of the pieces of federal legislation that's starting to actually move in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. So we're seeing banking reforms coming through. We're starting to see states' rights issues. So you're starting to see even movement on the federal level, which I think is a clear indication that the country is ready to put this prohibition behind it and start kind of moving forward and having law enforcement focusing on issues like trafficking, like all of the other crimes that are going on in the country, and stop focusing on cannabis arrests.
And the other thing, too, is this, because you talk about what hemp could be for the economy. Marijuana could be the same thing. I mean, do you look to other states, you look to Colorado and say, all right, maybe this could work here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you see the numbers in Colorado. I believe last year, I think they brought in like $300 to $500 million in revenue that goes to their state budget. And you know, unfortunately, I don't want to be a downer, but you know, we have had a tremendous economic boost in the last 10 years. It is just a matter of time that we're going to start hitting a recession. And when our state in particular is so reliant on tourism, unfortunately, that's the first disposable income that goes away to people. And so we've got to make sure that we have the revenue sources here to make sure that we've got industries that people can go in and get employment in, that we still have job growth, that we still have an opportunity to have an expanded economy. And I've always said that cannabis is the future of our state, because I do believe that the cannabis plant, and one, you see already the medical marijuana program's already hit $1 billion. Not taxable right now because it's still a medicine, but $1 billion. And then the hemp plant, I'm estimating to be $20 to $30 billion of really an industry that's great for agriculture, great for the environment, for small business owners, for minority business owners, and job growth that just would exceed anything that we would see from any other type of industry that we would bring here. So there is tremendous opportunity for this cannabis plant and for the hemp plant in particular for here in our state.
You are the solely elected Democrat to a statewide position. There was an editorial in the Sun Sentinel this past weekend discussing the significance of your role as the only progressive in the DeSantis cabinet. How do you see your role when you look forward on issues like gun control, on pot, and many other issues?
You know, it's not easy, because I you know, we all, and if you ask any member of the cabinet, we put state first, you know, and state before party. And of course, you know, some of these, you know, these issues, it's not partisan necessarily, but we're going to see differences of opinion. And it's my obligation to also be a check. You know, our democracy, the foundation of our democracy is built on a two-party system, three branches of government, really four branches of government. You are one of them as a free press. And it's important to have those checks and balances and competing voices. You know, going back to even what we were talking about earlier in the gun debate, having those competing voices is what gets us to compromise. It's what gets us to a better government. And when we're doing that together and coming to the middle and coming to compromise and coming to, you know, adult conversations that are difficult, but coming in with our big girl and big boy pants on to try to figure out what's best for our state, the only way to do that is there happens to be competing voices at the table. And that's the only way that we can move our state forward, is when we start having those conversations that are hard, those are difficult. But, you know, we are the proxy for our citizens, and we have a moral and ethical obligation to fulfill those needs of our state. And we've got to do that by having a checks and balance system in our state.
That was Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried discussing marijuana and gun control issues in Florida. And you can find more of our reporting on both of these stories and the follow-up on the mass shootings that occurred this weekend at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, how important is gold in supporting the Venezuelan economy? An investigation from the Miami Herald reveals some key details. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Miamians are buying gold in mass quantities, and a lot of it is coming from Venezuela. Now, that was a time when Venezuela used to be one of the wealthiest nations in South America. In the 70s and 80s, oil was a big part of that. But under the rule of former President Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, well, oil has lost a lot of its bluster. This has led Venezuela to economic turmoil. So the Maduro regime has turned to perhaps its last lifeline, gold. The gold mine in Venezuela and neighboring countries is essentially being smuggled by criminal gangs and drug traffickers to Colombia, through Colombia and the Caribbean, and then brought here to Miami. The Miami Herald's Jay Weaver was part of a team who reported on a series of stories. To tell more about it, it's called Venezuela Smuggler's Paradise, and he joins us now. Jay, always great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Louis.
I think we have to start by reminding people that, yeah, oil was essential to Venezuela's economy for a really long time. Not to say gold was there, but, I mean, oil was the big boy.
No, of course. It's like an OPEC country in the sense that it has these extraordinary reserves. It has exports not only to the United States through its own wholly owned company, Citgo, but also to Europe and to other countries around the world. And it was a cash cow. And it has always been a cash cow. But since Chavez and Maduro began experimenting with socialist government, it transformed this industry into a nationally owned industry, and the corruption followed. And it's been hemorrhaging billions of dollars a year. How? Through corrupt schemes and Venezuelan kleptocrats who put a lot of their billions in Europe and in the United States and in South Florida.
So is it accurate to say that the Maduro regime is basically still alive because of gold now?
I don't know if it's just because of gold, because there's still oil reserves and they still have cash reserves. But gold has been sort of like the last hurrah. They've been able to resort to gold to help prop up the regime. And they've done it through basically nationalizing the industry and then putting their cronies, including President Maduro's wife, you know, Celia Flores, and others, very much in charge of the industry. And so it helps. I wouldn't say that it's entirely dependent on it, but it helps.
How big is gold then coming out of Venezuela? How important is it to Venezuela?
Well, they can produce about 35, you know, metric tons a year, and Colombia can produce about 45 metric tons a year. And the fifth, you know, biggest producing country of gold in the world is Peru, and that's about 150 metric tons. So they're behind Peru, but it's still significant, especially when gold is selling for about $1,300, $1,400 an ounce. So the revenue is significant.
How did you find this story?
Well, it actually found us. And by that, I mean, we were already looking at a huge investigative case in Miami. It was a $3.6 billion money laundering case. And in short, it was about NTR Metals, a Miami company that was importing gold illegally mined in the countries of Peru and then smuggled out of Peru also to Bolivia and Ecuador and Colombia to some extent into Chile. And even, as we've later learned, through Venezuela and also through Curacao and through Aruba. And so we didn't write about the Venezuelan angle at first. We wrote about the Peruvian angle. It was big and we focused on that, but it grew out of that investigative experience.
There was a great diagram that the Miami Herald had about how basically this gold is moving through Venezuela, then Colombia, and it finds its way into Miami, then, of course, across the United States, and then the money gets siphoned back to Venezuela. Give me briefly, explain to me this, basically this, the route that gold is taking.
Well, first of all, you know, with the help of this consortium out of Brazil, Info Amazonia, as well as four or five other reporters, Jim Wiss, Nick Nahamas, Antonio Delgado, Kira Gurney, and a guy named, I always knew as Bram, they had all these records and they had all this on the ground reporting. And so what it became obvious was is that bringing in gold directly from Venezuela was verboten. It was prohibited. You can't do it. The country's radioactive. So you have to make it look like the gold is coming from somewhere else. So it is smuggled into these Caribbean countries or into Colombia, and it's written up, fabricated, as if it originated there. And then it comes into the United States. Now, when it comes into the United States, this is all done through wire transfers. So the money goes back to the point of origin. And eventually, it is either paid directly back to the Venezuelan source, or it's paid directly to some sort of a exporter and or a guerrilla group and or a, you know, political affiliate, or a group like the ELN, which is a leftist group, or the Venezuelan military. But it's not like they have open accounts and the money goes back to them directly. It's either paid to them in cash or gold. But it's done through these same routes that they've been using for drug traffickers, that they were using for gold coming in from other parts of the country. And the money is just basically done through wire transfers. It comes in on air flights, you know, through MIA, and the money goes back. And eventually it filters to the source.
I'm talking with Jay Weaver, reporter for the Miami Herald and part of a group that recently contributed to this series looking at how Miami is a major destination for Venezuelan gold. The series is called Venezuela Smuggler's Paradise. You can find out more about it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Why is Miami the landing spot? I think I know, but why?
Well, you know, because it's the gateway to Latin America. And what does that mean in this context? It's the closest to Latin America. And why does that matter? Because in the gold business, it's a spot price. It's the same price pretty much in every location on a given day. So the guy who makes the deal here in Miami, who's importing that gold, you know, wants to be first. And so this is the first place you can bring it into the country. And until this big crackdown on NTR metals, Miami was bringing in a lot of illegal gold mined in these remote areas of the rainforest, devastating the environment there, exploiting workers. And it takes on this kind of patina of blood gold, meaning it's been extracted on the backs of really poor people, indigenous people, and the environment is being destroyed. And the people in the United States don't really know anything about it. And so Miami becomes this point of entry. And then from here, it can be refined here as it was at places like Republic and a few others. But it also will then be sent, you know, in these crude bars to other parts of the United States. And then eventually, and people don't realize this, that the gold they're buying really ends up in their smartphones, in their cars. It ends up in their jewelry. It can be Tiffany & Company. It can be Verizon. It can be General Motors. But what is happening is the American people are really not as wise to the origins of this gold and how tainted it is. And it's kind of akin to blood diamonds. And this is why Africa is off limits for so much gold.
And actually, interesting you said that. I didn't even know that until some time ago. I learned there is gold in our smartphones. How it's being brought into Miami, I thought was the fascinating part of the story. I mean, as you said, they're bringing in these gold bars. And I'm thinking, how are you getting that through? How is that coming through?
That's a good question. It gets through these areas. That's places like Colombia, Curacao, and Aruba don't even manufacture gold, don't harvest gold, you know, so they don't really have an industry. They're just transshipment points. So basically, you have a lot of customs, freight forwarders, officials being paid off to make the paperwork look like the gold originated there. I mean, it's improbable because these countries don't produce gold. But in Colombia's case, it does produce gold. So it's easier to blend the good with the bad. Some of it's legitimate, some of it's not legitimate. But when it's coming into this country, if it looks like it came from a legitimate source, you can't question it, you can't challenge it. And, you know, you assign it to a certain buyer here, it comes in, and then it's redistributed.
Tell us, what is smurfing?
Well,
this goes to how it's being brought in here.
Smurfing, it's sort of like how mules used to bring in and still bring in cocaine from places like Colombia and Peru. You know, but it's kind of like the retail version of it, not the wholesale version. And you have individuals who literally will wear this on their person. They'll wear it in planes. They'll wear it around their necks on, you know, as bracelets. And they'll literally bring it into this country. They have to declare it. And there are certain limits to how much you can bring in. But it's really sort of a very slow, you know, process. Just like with the cocaine, although with cocaine you had to hide it on your person. Here you can wear it in plain sight. And then they take it down to the Sable building, which is the, you know, the jewelry and precious metals marketplace right on Flagler Street. And there are people there willing and ready to buy it. And so That's the smurfing way, but it's the slow way.
Well, because again, you're limited at how much you can carry and how much you can, again, as you said, report when you get here. You mentioned this. This is the other aspect of it is the fact that, like blood diamonds, I mean, it's on the backs of poor people, and the things that are happening to them as they're trying to get this gold, but also the damage that's being done to the environment. I mean, in some cases, you've got all kinds of chemicals going into the water and the damage that it's creating to these local environments in Venezuela and Colombia. That's not discussed that often. Well, usually when we talk about anything that's going on in South America, it's the Amazon rainforest that we're deforesting. But this is almost as bad.
Well, it is as bad because what you have here is not only just the devastation of whole, you know, hundreds and hundreds of square miles of forests, but you also have pollution in the rivers, pollution in the lakes, pollution in, you know, the food supply. And what's the pollution from? It's from mercury, because mercury is used in these very primitive gold operations to separate, you know, gold from the other rock ore. And so it's used, it's dangerous, and it's poisonous, and it can kill you. And it's not just getting into people's blood systems, but it's getting into the water supply, the food supply. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why the Pope went down to Madre de Dios, or Puerto Maldonado in Peru, early last year, and he spoke about this false god, you know, that you have the first world, you know, and all of its vanity gobbling up all this gold while it's destroying the third world and ruining their lives, and everybody is sort of being sacrificed at this human altar of gold.
Real briefly, what is the Trump administration doing on this? Can authorities really do anything on this? The way, considering, again, they're trying to go through Colombia to try to get it in here.
Right. Well, the Trump administration, far more so than the Obama administration, has taken a much more aggressive position against the socialist government. How have they done this? By sanctioning hundreds of individuals and hundreds of companies that are either involved in the oil business or involved in the gold business. Because all of this has been nationalized. It's all been exploited, and all this money has just gone overseas. Because they not only steal it, but they invest it in Switzerland, Malta, and in the United States, and in South Florida real estate. So we have cracked down as a country. The Trump administration has been very aggressive against Maduro, his family, and all of their cronies.
Always fascinating to learn what is coming through Miami. So many things. The series is called Venezuela Smuggler's Paradise by the Miami Herald. Jay Weaver, one of the reporters who worked on that. Jay, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Louis.
By the way, you can check out that series on our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, still to come, this week is the start of the Popcorn Frights Film Festival. This year, the focus, female directors in the horror genre. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, this week is the launch of the 5th Annual Popcorn Frights Film Festival. It's a collection of local and international films, some feature films, some shorts. And this year, the focus of the festival will be on women in the genre. Now, the horror film industry has been mostly male-dominated. We recently spoke with Alexandria Perez, a writer and director of the short The Final Girl Returns, and Erin Dalton, director of the feature film The Gravedigger. Erin, by the way, runs Infinite Abyss Productions. That's a South Florida company that produces mostly horror plays at the Wilton Theater Factory. We talked about the role in women in horror filmmaking, and we started with how they fell in love with the genre. I wanted to start with both of you on this question. Why are you so into horror stories, horror movies? Why do you want to make them? Erin, let me start with you.
I don't know. I mean, I've loved horror since I was a five-year-old kid. I read Jaws when I was six. I was just a weird kid. So just obsessed from the time I was a little girl, and, you know, put on like Friday the 13th plays in my backyard. and then went into acting and then subsequently directing on stage. And I created a horror theater where we do live horror shows. So it just stayed with me my whole life.
Aaron, Jaws, was that the first horror film you watched?
It was the first horror novel I read, actually. I was six. I was a nerdy kid.
My producer just told me Jaws is not horror. Yes, it is.
It absolutely is. I totally agree. It's horror.
It's definitely horror.
Think of all the people that wouldn't go in the water after they saw Jaws because they were terrified.
Absolutely. I'm one of them. Alexandria, how about you? What is it about horror for you? And yeah, what was the first movie you ever watched?
Well, the first horror movie I ever watched, I remember it was like Thanksgiving, and we watched The Shining as a family. Like, it was a nice little family event. We watched, you know, this man go crazy and try to murder the rest of his family. And Jaws was actually a really big starting point for me too. My parents took me to Universal, and I rode the theme ride, you know, like the, you remember the boat ride?
The Jaws ride, yeah.
Yeah, the Jaws boat ride. And that actually triggered a really big phobia of sharks for me. So
Did I get that right? Hold on. You said for Thanksgiving, you had a family gathering to watch The Shining?
Yeah, and we watched it like 3 years in a row. Like, and so now it's definitely something I try to uphold to this day, as I like watching The Shining on Thanksgiving.
I love your family. Awesome family.
Yeah, my family is so great, honestly.
That and, is like, a strange holiday movie to pick, but okay.
The Grudge was reserved for Christmas, you know?
That is fantastic. Let's talk about your films. Both of you have films in this year's Popcorn Frights Film Festival. Aaron, let me start with you. Yours is called The Gravedigger. And this is linked to the story of Frankenstein. Is this a continuation of that story?
It is. It takes a page out of Mary Shelley's classic novel, Frankenstein. The writer is Joseph Zettelmeyer, and he's a playwright in the United States. And he wrote this as kind of a continuation. In the original novel, the monster kills all of Victor Frankenstein's friends and family, and then he runs away to the frozen north, and you don't really know what happens to the monster. And this is a continuation of that, and posits that this is where the monster went. He went to this desolate graveyard in Bavaria and meets this lone gravedigger who is also in a bad spot mentally, and they just kind of help each other find their souls again.
You helped him before, why won't you help me now?
Yeah, it's not so simple.
Explain it to me.
I can't.
I want to understand.
Stop talking. Will you just shut your flapping jaws for a trice? I've been alone for a long while here. It's the way I prefer it.
And you actually did this as a play first, right?
We did. Yeah, I think we can claim that we were the first to ever go directly from stage to screen with concept or an adaptation, and using the same cast as well.
Why do you think the story of Frankenstein is so compelling? I mean, this is a story that was written in the 19th century, but it still captivates people today.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of factors. First is the sense of man to want to play God and mess with nature. That's always a cautionary tale, no matter how old or new the story is. And then also there's a bit of a redemption story in Frankenstein as well. You know, he's a monster in the novel, but in a lot of subsequent versions, he does have a soul, or he does find humanity. So I think that's also very compelling.
Alexandria, you directed one of the shorts for this year's festival. It's called The Final Girl Returns. It sort of plays on the whole horror movie trope, the young teenage girl that's chased by the monster. But tell us a little bit about the story.
Yeah, I was really interested in what happens after the horror film kind of comes to a close. You know, you get the formulaic story. Bunch of kids go to a cabin. They get hunted one by one by a serial killer. And then this girl runs off, is picked up by a driver, drives off into sunset, but you don't know what happens next.
So what happens now?
I give you a choice to change your own ending.
You realize you can't go back, right?
It doesn't matter that...
Oh my God. It's him? Drive! Drive! Coming.
This has never happened before.
And I was, like, specifically, like, one of my biggest influences was Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, you have that magnificent final shot of, like, Leatherface with the chainsaw and this, like, as the sun is starting to rise. And I wanted to know what was coming next. Not in the sense of, like, a sequel, but, like, the continuation of this trauma. And, you know, they just finished battling these demons, but how does this follow you and how does this continue to haunt you? And I was interested in addressing all those themes in my short film.
What is it about that particular, you know, trope in horror films? It's the young woman being chased by the monster, and she's always the last one left. And
final girl.
And she usually ends up killing or escaping the monster.
That trope it's gone through many evolutions. You know, she used to be somewhat virginal and like this pure character, but with films like Scream and Your Next, that trope has changed so much, and it represents this kind of warrior of a young woman. And like what it's begun to represent to me is really female empowerment, owning, you know, reclaiming your narrative, owning your power, fending off the bad guy, because I mean, the monsters are metaphors.
How does that change for a female director? You wrote and directed this film. So how does that narrative, that trope change? You know, you talk about the empowerment, but now you're telling the story. It's coming from a female perspective, not a male perspective.
For me, it's a continuation of that empowerment. You know, in general, I want to empower all my characters in their own way. Every character is significant to me. And telling that story, it's not like it's about empowerment and like I get to empower myself, because you can address so many elements in telling horror stories. You know, you can confront insecurities chasing demons. You can confront problems in a household or problems in a town, problems internally. And you can have all of this not just be figurative. It can be actual, like, living, breathing human beings that you can confront or face off against. And everything feels so much more tangible in horror when you get to tell those stories.
I'm talking with directors Aaron Dalton and Alexandria Perez. Their films are part of the Popcorn Frights Film Festival beginning this week. This year's festival is focusing on women in horror. Now you can find a full list of screenings and more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. One of the interesting things we talk about this on the program from time to time is, you know, the film industry in general. And it used to come to South Florida, used to come to Florida a lot. And obviously different states, different countries offer different tax incentives. But as filmmakers, young filmmakers, does that impact you, Alexandria? You did film yours out in the desert, out west.
I did.
Florida being a good or bad place for filmmakers, is this ideal? Does it matter if you have those opportunities, that the tax incentives, or is it where you want to go?
You know, something, it's changed so much. I think it's helpful to have those tax incentives. You know, it can be a very expensive process. Even if you're doing low budget filmmaking, you're spending a dime here, a nickel dime, I'm sure Aaron can attest to that too. It's passion. It's all passion projects, and the tax incentives that can really help. And what helps is when a city is pro filmmaking. Like South Florida has really become pro filmmaking, which is really, really great. Like I would say specifically, like in the last 10 years, it's become a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I have a responsibility to my producers/investors to, you know, get the best deal that we can when we're making a film. And Gravedigger was very, very small budget, with the goal of moving forward and you know, getting investors for a larger budgeted project. It would be hard to justify staying in Florida, because, you know, when you look at some of our neighboring states like Georgia, North Carolina, who offer really generous tax incentives, any producer worth his or her salt would say, why are we not filming there? Because we're going to get so much more bang for our buck.
Aaron, you run a theater group. What's kept you here? I mean, if opportunities financially seem better elsewhere, what's kept you here?
Well, absolutely, I have a business that I run here in the community, so that keeps me here. I will always, on top of being a filmmaker, also love the stage, and I'd love to keep my business, my theater business as well. But it doesn't have to be one or the other. I can have roots here in South Florida and also make films elsewhere.
You do horror theater. That's your focus.
Correct.
How do you do that? And what kind of shows do you put on?
We do a lot of original work. Some of it's written by us. Some of it's written by other playwrights, either in the community or outside of the community. And then we also do some existing works as well. But they always skew to the darkness, some to the gothic, some to even slasher. We try to cover all the genres. And also we do a lot of immersive theater, which means, you know, not traditional sitting people in seats and watching a show on the stage. They are moving through their environment, kind of like a haunted house, but with a story and, you know, really talented actors to bring them into the story. And we just have the philosophy that we don't want theater to be comfortable for people. We want them to be immersed in it and not know what's going to happen next.
Do you have a splash zone to imagine the first front rows?
Well, yeah, we've splashed a few of our patrons. Luckily, they kind of know what they're in for when they get there. So.
Alexandria, you moved out west. You're in L.A. I wondered, what's it like to break into the horror genre as a woman?
It's phenomenal. It's like, in general, not just horror, like every genre needs more diverse voices. For me, it's about diverse storytelling. You know, I'm Cuban. My parents came to this country from Cuba, and like, I'm not just like Cuban, but as a young woman, and I know there's been a lot of controversy surrounding whether or not female voices even exist in horror. And I'm so proud of the fact that like, I get to be part of a collective of female filmmakers that are telling horror stories, and that they're being showcased at the festival also, and that you guys will get a chance to see them all.
What does horror look like from that female perspective? I mean, I have to admit, as a man of a certain age, you know, I grew up in the 80s with those Friday the 13th movies, the stereotypes, the monster chasing all the teenagers. But, it, you know, with more women getting into this as writers, as directors, how does horror change? I want to hear from both of you. Alexandria, I'll start with you.
Being a woman can be kind of difficult in this, like in this society and in the world. Sometimes it can be scary to go outside at night and walk to your car. And so for me, horror represents the internal. It like all the fears that are within you, it's about manifesting them to the outside. I've always been drawn to the psyche. And so I love psychological horror. I love horror that makes that kind of forces the audience to analyze the situation, to analyze how they might approach a certain situation. Even if it's a slasher or an invasion, I love when horror films don't hesitate. And by not hesitating, it's like they jump right into the madness. They throw you into the thick of it, and you're in there, and you can't escape. It's no holds barred.
Aaron, what about you? What's the female perspective on horror? How does horror have to change?
Well, okay, so like you, Lewis, I'm a female of a certain age, and I grew up on all those same horror films that you did, and loved the fact that, you know, the final girl was female. I mean, I think that's really how and why I connected, because these were strong women. Surviving what would be a seemingly really impossible and traumatic situation. And I carry all of that through in my vision as well. I just, for me, character, you know, the development of the character, whether it's female or male, makes a big difference for me in a story. I have no patience for a horror film, whether it's directed by a man or a woman, where the characters make really dumb choices where you're like, oh, come on, really? So I try really hard to, you know, put myself in that character's shoes and say, well, what would be a reasonable response? I have a degree in psychology, too, so that helps me a lot in writing and directing and figuring out what a character would really do. So I don't know if it's fair to say that female voices go deeper into the psyche. But I think that's the trend of where horror is going when you see films like Hereditary with, you know, stellar actors like Toni Collette taking on a role like that, who was amazing. And, you know, it's just adding more legitimacy to the genre. And let's face it, the genre makes a lot of money. It's a very profitable industry. So I'm just really grateful that, you know, there is that allowance for a diversity of voices coming through the genre now.
Aaron Dalton and Alexandria Perez, both directors. They have films in this year's Popcorn Frights Film Festival. It starts this week. You can get the full list of screenings and more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Aaron, Alexandria, I really appreciate the time. Thank you for the scares. Always enjoy those.
Thank you for
having
me.
Thank you.
And I wish you both the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can learn more about the festival and all the movies on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And yes, Jaws is a horror film. Thank you. That's our show for this Monday, August 5th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Joshua Johnson from the NPR program 1A is in town, and we are going to dedicate the full show to the question, what is the state of journalism here in South Florida? We'll speak with Joshua and a panel of reporters about the stories they followed throughout their career and the challenges they faced in the course of their reporting. What are your questions, by the way, about journalism? Are there stories that aren't getting enough coverage? Maybe some get just enough. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial, or you can email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day, a scary one. Talk to you tomorrow.